Hello, this is Pearl M Podcast. I'm really, it's a great pleasure. Today I'm sitting here in this beautiful gallery called Sit Motion. I mean, I think everybody should really come to visit this gallery. It's very exciting with all these emerging artists. Now, I'm sitting here with Jen Daly. So Jen, can you introduce yourself?
Yes. Well, first of all, Pearl, thank you so much for having me and for inviting me to join you on your podcast, which is a fabulous series, and I've enjoyed it so much. So I'm delighted to be here. I'm Jan Daly. I'm the arts editor of the Financial Times, a job that I've had for quite a number of years, although it's grown a lot over the years, so it's changed. We, at the FT, are a very international paper, and we try to cover the arts more or less across the world, which of course is an impossible task.
Not possible.
Yes, but we have a go at it anyway.
I met Jen during when Jen was interviewing me with Lunch with FT. That was quite some years ago.
It was.
So we kept in touch, and every year I saw Jen in Hong Kong for the Art Basel Hong Kong. You started as a literary journalist in FT.
I did. Yes.
What do you read in university to lead you in and into journalism?
I read English at university, and then I did various different things. You know, tried sort of different jobs here and there. But the job that I really most in my the early job that I most enjoyed was a job in publishing. I worked at Chatto & Windus, which is a very long established London publishing house. And then I started writing about books, reviewing books for various magazines. And then gradually, from reviewing the books, I sort of moved into editing. And I worked with various editors. And then when The Independent on Sunday began in London, one of the editors who I worked with went to be the literary editor there, and he asked me to come with him and be his deputy. And that's where I began.
How wonderful. So then you started with FT as a literary journalist.
Yes,
how
I did.
So then you moved to arts. Is there must be a big difference between literature, because you love reading. I presume you love books.
I do.
Right, and then you go for arts. And arts, that means that you never go back home. Every day there's so many art shows, and there's theatres, opera, music, performance art, and all over the world. So how do you manage this?
Well, I manage it with a team of fantastic writers who I commission to cover what they want to cover. And many of them are based in Britain, but a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are based around the world. And so they are great because they keep me in touch with what's happening. So, and I rely on them totally.
Yeah.
Not every writer is great for every event, even if they're a good writer. And so we do the same with classical music, with pop, with theatre, with dance, with opera. And now with the new forms like podcasts. And
so you actually have a person there listen to most of the podcast?
We have a person who chooses a podcast.
She's serious, because there's so many podcasts nowadays.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
And also video games. Now, video games is an interesting case because...
It is really interesting, the video games.
Did you know that the video games market, in terms of the sheer size of the market financially, is bigger than the whole of the film industry and the whole of the music industry put together?
What?
Yeah. It's absolutely incredible. Video games are just astounding.
And completely shocking.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Because I mean, America has come up with really good video games, but China is also, and Japan, they all have really incredible video games. Mm. I didn't realize there's so many people playing the video games.
Yeah, I think so. And I think of all ages as well, because people
do start... Do I really miss out because I don't play video games? Maybe tonight I should start one.
I'm afraid I don't. I don't either. So in this, in that, it's...
Because what
I really do have to rely on my team and on our writers to tell us what, you know, what's good, what's interesting. But they tend to... They do write about individual games, but also they tend to write about kind of themes within games. So, and now video games cover everything. I mean, everything you can imagine, from, you know, pretending to be a farmer to things that cover mental health.
Amazing.
Things that cover, I mean, traditionally, of course, they're, you know, there's a lot of fighting. A lot of biffing.
Fighting.
A lot of biffing in video games, but and a lot of fantasy. Yeah. But there are lots of other things as
Because the graphics is beautiful.
You can have a video game about how to raise a cow, or, I mean, anything, everything has
been
made.
The only reason why I refuse to do video game is because I'm compulsive obsessive. So okay, if I start with a game, I would be just sitting down, facing the iPad and not moving.
Yeah, you'd be there literally all night.
Literally, all the time, because I know my weaknesses. Yeah. I can't pull myself out. And I see kids nowadays are just focusing. But I didn't know the industry is so big.
It's enormous, yeah. And so I think they are designed for obsessive behaviour, actually. That's the attraction, I think, that you can literally disappear into your cocoon and play this thing. People play them with each other. There is a sociable element.
But do you
element.
Think that because of these new games, the new ways to entertain, the new entertainment, kids today, actually, they are not as social as when I'm growing up?
Well, it's certainly true that between that and social media.
Yeah, because they just don't
You don't necessarily have to go out, do you?
Yeah, they don't need to go out and make effort to do whatever, you know? Mm. So, wow, you really cover a huge range of arts. And I didn't realise that video games is considered as arts as well.
Well, I had a bit of a struggle with myself about that. And first of all, when we first started covering video games, I asked the writers to write very particularly about the arts aspects, because of course there, you know, a lot of artists are employed.
Of course, absolutely.
A lot of musicians are employed.
Yeah.
In fact,
absolutely.
For young musicians, it's a very big source of income. Mm. Designers are employed, people who do lighting, people who do, these are filmmaking techniques, so there are an awful lot of techniques which are in the making of video games, which are specifically drawn from the older art forms. And it's particularly interesting about the music, I think, the instrumentalists. And of course it also links to writing, because of narrative, these games need narrative.
Yes, narrative.
So there's script writing, but then there's also all kinds of other things. I mean, they employ psychiatrists, they employ sociologists. Yes, in the making of video games. Yes. They employ...
Totally enlightening moment for me.
They employ urbanists who understand about cities, because, you know, quite a lot of the games are sort of action-based, and there are always sort of chases and pathways and places you have to go. So anybody, probably somebody who's an expert on traffic lights, I don't know, they're all employed in video games.
What?
It's an incredible industry.
It's serious an industry.
Yeah.
I didn't realise.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to really go and start reviewing, studying video games. Maybe I should invite one of the video game maker to be on my podcast to enlighten me.
Yes, that would be very good.
Really?
Well, you could get somebody who would talk about, because I'm not really qualified to do it, but the link, of course, between the visual language of video games and the video and the visual language of new forms of art that we're seeing, digital art of various kinds.
Yes, it is definitely linked with digital art, animation and all that. That is really strong. I think you're absolutely right.
Huge numbers of animators, of course, are employed.
The video, I think the video art has definitely influenced the taste in art, the general as and in art is completely expanded.
Yeah. And the other thing that's happening now with games, oh, listen to me, I'm talking as if I know something about them. I don't really, but I do read what
my writers write. But you know more than I do.
is that all the sort of techniques and the tropes in the visual language of video games is now moving into mainstream movies, so that there are new movies being made which are, they really look like video games, but of course they employ, you know, the great actors and things. Of course. So it's moving, you know, in and out, and also some of the, you know, with music, there's a kind of cross-fertilization as well with with all the art forms.
So does FT actually covers a lot on video games, as much as, you know, what the world is you know, is happening and is affected by this video games?
We do a fair bit. Yeah, we do a fair bit. And of course, because it's a, you know, because it's an important industry, it's obviously of interest to, you know,
to
general colleagues. And then of course it moves into social media and into streaming, and so there's a lot of crossover between those worlds.
Recently you wrote something about the light box.
Yeah.
And about nowadays you need to emerge into the show, the light box, and then you, of course, now the trend is everybody goes to a show, they do selfie.
Yeah.
They're taking pictures of themselves with the painting instead of really appreciating the work.
They do.
Work. Yeah. What do you think, and how do you think that the current behavior, I mean, visitor behavior, what are you thinking? And do you think that in the future, this sort of behavior will become a huge thing, and that would really give importance, more and more importance, and importance for immersive art?
Well, in some ways, I'm probably the wrong person to ask, but simply because of my age, and I'm just a different generation.
Of course, you are.
I just cannot understand the urge to walk into a gallery and take a picture of yourself.
Yes.
I mean, I love just it. I can't get it. Yeah. But I was talking to a curator the other day, a younger curator, who was saying that she does quite big institutional shows. And she said that there's something that she now thinks about very much, which is the very, very, very first room, or even the first work that you see in this show. Because even if you have, you know, multiple rooms of beautiful works, she knows that what's going to happen is that a lot of people are going to come in. They're going to stand in the middle of the floor in the first room. They're going to take a picture of themselves, and they're going to tweet about what they see. So effectively,
you're marketing.
It's the first thing. And that's like, right, I've reviewed this show. You know, I can see this and I can see that. And here I am in this show. You don't wait till the end to do it. You don't wait till you've seen everything in the show. You do it right away. So the opening blast of a show is incredibly important now. Whereas it used to just be like the sort of hallway, didn't it? You just kind of walked through, and then you wanted to kind of explore and go further and everything. And of course, people probably do that as well. But the fact is that that the first impressions of a show are now incredibly important curatorially.
The curator has to think about that as well.
I believe so.
I mean, I'm from old school as well, because I thought, wow, taking selfie in a museum or in a gallery, I thought, wow, this is pretty unusual. Then when I open the shows, I have people who come to me and say, can I take a picture with you? And I said, aren't you taking a picture of the painting?
Yeah.
So I think all these are generally is a big change in human behavior when you're visiting art works. I mean, accepting it. And also, you're absolutely right, because sometimes I'm working with some artist, they would say that, oh, you know, my show is very Instagrammable. And that create a load of traffic, because there are a lot of kids, especially younger generation, because if you are Instagrammable, they attract the younger generation, and there's non-stop people coming and visiting the show. It's incredible. I think with that,
it's very powerful.
It's powerful in a way, especially for a museum, if they want to cultivate a younger generation.
Yeah.
And Gen Z, this is the only way that they can attract Gen Z. I can see it from my own gallery as well. And also, what is amazing is they have no patience for long video. It has to be very short.
Yeah.
Short video, and that engages them. So I think all these social media is actually very important for art shows. Do you agree with
me? It is. I agree with you completely. And I think that it's easy if you're, you know, my generation, it's easy to say, oh, goodness, this is shocking. You know, the kids aren't looking at the work. They're just interested in the social media possibilities and all the rest. But on the other hand, I mean, there are great things about it. One of the very good things is that it's almost certainly bringing people, younger people, into museums and galleries who would never have visited before. And I think that's particularly true of galleries like this one, commercial galleries, selling galleries. I mean, when I was young, we didn't dare go into those galleries in Cork Street and places. They were so...
Because...
Sort of, you know, they were like temples, and there was this eagle-eyed, perfectly made-up woman who was kind of going to look at you, and you didn't feel you were allowed in.
But
we used to go to museums and public places, but we never went to private galleries. Whereas now, with the Instagram generation, people are understanding that these are amazing resources, beautiful shows for free. It doesn't matter if you're not going to buy anything, but you can educate yourself about art.
Absolutely.
And maybe one day you will buy something, but that doesn't really matter.
But I think most of the galleries are very intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
So people have to take a lot of courage to walk into a gallery, to actually visit them, to view them. I don't understand why us galleries has to put on this very intimidating look. Up to now, I didn't understand. But we do. We do. Maybe it's because you're not supposed to go up and say hello. You try to service them or bring them around because they're supposed to roam about. But nowadays, when I go to New York or in London, you see more people, more younger people who would go and visit galleries, maybe because of the Instagram, the marketing.
I think that, so.
That gives them the confidence that you can walk in.
Yeah. And there's a wonderful free shows which change all the time. You can find out about art. You can, and also, but, you know, I think the intimidating thing, I think it's quite simple. It's like going into a shop where you know you can't afford the prices. I mean, you know, if you...
but then you can still look at it, view it.
But, you know, you probably wouldn't go into a shop selling very expensive jewellery if you knew you couldn't afford it, because you would be... Well, you're sort of scared that somebody will try and sell you something, I suppose. But no, I think on the whole, on balance, I think it's been a very good thing for the art world generally, that social media makes it seem more accessible, more democratic, more outward facing than if it wasn't on social media.
I think it's
done us a favour, actually.
I know quite a few artists who do not have gallery representation. So most of the time how they sell is through Instagram.
Yes.
How do you think about that? Do you think that this would actually collapse the structure, you know, the art world, the art world structure, you know, together that you online selling and all that? What do you think about that?
I think artists will always want a show. They'll always want to have an exhibition.
And how about a show online?
Well, yes, but for some reason that doesn't, you know, if they're making physical work, if they're making digital work, that's different because that exists online. But if you're making physical work, if you've actually got this, and this is what you've made, and it has paint and it has, you know, it's in 3D and everything, however great it looks online, and it might or might not look great online,
right.
The artist is going to want you to see it, and the artist is going to want to see their show. And I think actually a lot of the big galleries now put on shows almost to please the artists, because there are many artists, as you well know now, who Absolutely. don't need an exhibition. They've got a waiting list.
Yes.
That, I mean, they don't actually need to show their work, because there are people who say, if it's by so-and-so, I want to buy the next one.
Yeah. On the wait list.
But the artist.
The artist definitely
I think the
artist because
wants
they
the
want
show.
To see all the works together in a room. And they want other people, not just the collector. They want the public to go there to appreciate the work.
Of course, because otherwise nobody new would ever see that work, really, would they? Because, yes, I mean, some of the work, of course, goes into institutions, but the great majority of it goes off into private hands.
Not just the private home, in storages.
Yes, and storage, and we'll never see it again. Yeah. And the artists themselves, unless they have a... I mean, I was talking the other day to Michael Craig Martin, who's having a retrospective after 50 years or 60 years even of making work, and he's finding work that he of his own that he hasn't seen for 50 years. But also he was telling me that he really loves it because there's so much of his early work that no one has seen, because he wasn't a well-known name at the time he made it. So his retrospective will be completely revelatory to many of us.
Oh.
And slightly to himself as well.
That's great.
So it's wonderful, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, that's at the Royal Academy, and that's very much their job to put on huge shows like that. But even at the other end of the food chain, as it were, when the work is new and new made, that's actually sometimes our only chance to see it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But having said all that, if I really want, you know, we think about the Gen Z and what they like, and then the older generation. Okay, let's talk about conceptual art.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so conceptual art, usually you have to read before you appreciate conceptual art. When conceptual art is always talking about politics, sociology, psychology, philosophy. Gen Z has no patience to read before you look at the art. Do you think this will change? Do you think that, you know, this conceptual art will still hold its importance in the next, in the next page of the evolution of the art world?
I think you're right that it's a very generational taste.
Yes, I mean...
I think many younger artists and many younger viewers, people who are interested in art... You're right, they're not particularly interested in conceptual art.
No, because when you have to read, even as you ask them to look at an Instagram, reading or listening to an interview or that, they have no patience.
Mm.
So this is what I'm seeing. This is a little bit of a shake-up. Because, I mean, recently, one of my younger artists who said, he only wants to make art to make people happy. Mm. Nothing about conception, nothing about that. And his show was in Holborn Museum, Mr. Doodle.
Yeah.
And that generates huge numbers of younger, you mean teenagers and younger adults. They all went and visited a show which break the record. God, it is unimaginable that these artists who is not talking about being intellectual, talking about politics, talking about, so can generate this crowd. So how are these conceptual artists going to evolve? because all the conceptual artists, they read a lot, they all, and all their artworks are talking about today's world. So is the general taste in the art is changing? This is what I've been looking at my older artists, which is completely genuine, and with these younger artists, they're running two separate directions.
Yes. It's very interesting. But maybe it's always been like this.
Maybe.
Do you think that it's always been the case that a new generation does slightly reject the art of just before? Sometimes they like older art, but
I don't even think that they reject. It's just that, I mean, today, I mean, the younger people behave very differently.
Yes.
Their attention span is so short.
Yes.
Right? Mm. And then, you know, I think all the art world and all the taste in design art is catering to them, because you cannot engage them to bring them into an institution.
Mm.
And as galleries, you know, of course, we would love to have a younger generation coming, you know, a younger, cultivating younger collectors.
Mm.
But the taste is completely different.
Mm.
So how are we going to transform these artists, these collectors, to appreciate the older way, I mean, the older gen? It's always been challenging.
I think it's always cyclical, and things come. I mean, it seems odd to talk about fashion when you're talking about serious art, but there are fashions, as we know, there are waves of fashion in art, and sometimes an artist, you know, hits a wave and then
absolutely
goes out of, you know, out of interest, but sometimes comes back again, often a long time later, maybe when they're not even alive anymore.
Absolutely. There's many instances like
yes.
that.
I think the
Van Gogh.
Yes. And yeah. I think one of the things that's so interesting now with this huge number of much, much older women artists coming to the fore now, women who are in their 80s and 90s who've never really had a
show. Because of the market. Because the market, because the political need now is diversity.
Yes.
But I'm also thinking about younger artists who paint without that importance of conceptually.
Mm.
So how are they going to evolve? You know, it's both ways, right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to investigate what is the next stage of both, you know, the market and also for the younger and artists. How could they evolve?
I think the younger generation, the digital natives onwards, they've learned to see in very different ways.
But the digital artist is nothing. They're not conceptual at all.
No, exactly.
No. They're moving images and all that. So we have to see how are they going to evolve. Of course, they're evolving together with their collectors. But the both has to evolve in certain ways. So are they going to become, what is the new language? Which is a new visual net language? How are they think in the next, you know, in the next stage? So all that is very interesting.
It's very interesting. And I think the scene is very diverse now, very diverse.
I'm trying to study, I'm trying to understand, I'm trying to research, because we all want to know what is the next stage, right?
Of course. But if we think about acquiring art, people who are buying art, which of course is your expertise and not mine, but I think that there are still barriers to the buying of art which isn't physical.
Yes.
I mean, there are not many people who are really going to take a big risk on that. There are some, of course, there are always some.
Like when NFT was very hot.
Yes, and that went quite quickly, didn't it?
And that went down because of the digital market. I mean, because digital currency, the cryptocurrency. Now cryptocurrency is back, but the NFT is still weak.
Yes.
So I think you need to have something that anchor.
Yes, I think so. And I think that one of the effects that it has, because the artists affect the market, but the market affects the artists as well, right?
Yeah.
So I think that if you're a young artist and you actually want to live your life as an artist and earn enough money to survive as an artist, you will probably be encouraged into making physical works, which might stylistically reflect some of the work that you did digitally, but will be physical works of some sort. They might be 3D, it might be in film form, it might be something, because otherwise you can't sell it. I mean, it's very hard to sell. No,
because when we talk about contemporary art, right, so we talk about contemporary culture, and a contemporary culture is about technology. So obviously, if they do digital art, they're reflecting what the world is about technology. So, but is the collectors going to catch up with that, to understand what it is? So these are, there's a big gap between what is representing, and you're right. I mean, the older generation who's used to collecting art, it's very difficult for us to ask them to buy a digital art, an art piece. The younger generation should maybe, but then what? I remember like 10, 15 years ago, I bought a lot of kinetic art and digital and everything. But every year or every 2 years, I have to change the software.
Yes.
Software. Mm. And the maintaining is really difficult. Now I took everything down.
Did
and
you?
Put it yeah. in storage because it's much easier than to hang a canvas.
Yes.
Than hanging a digital art. Mm. So all that, I think, we are only seeing as the art world is evolving, we are, and artists is moving that, we are trying to catch up. By the way we catch up, they move to other ways. So it's very interesting about all that. And what do you think about being an art critic and art journalism? It's very different.
It's very difficult, yes, because I have, I work with a lot of really good writers who are extraordinary in their appreciation and their ability to appreciate. And some of them can write 1 week about Leonardo and Raphael, and the next week they can write about a work that was made last week.
Wow.
But not any work that was made last week. I mean, there are very, very few people who would, dare to write about absolutely everything across the board. And I wouldn't ask them to, because of course not, would be ridiculous to try that. And there's no doubt that some people, have a better appreciation of other forms. But if I could ask you a question,
okay,
I'd be fascinated to know about how you see the balance of the art world changing geographically. I mean, earlier we were chatting and you said that you felt that the energy was definitely moving out of London
out
and towards
of London.
Paris.
Yeah.
But also, in terms of Hong Kong versus Europe or America, I mean, that's always in balance, isn't it?
I think we never can escape politics, right? Politics means everything. And this anti-China sentiment, US-China trade is huge. This conflict is huge. And there's a lot of anti-China sentiment. To the extent that when you go to America now, you see literally to zero really Chinese artists exhibition. I talked to one of the institution director. They said politically incorrect to show any Chinese artists show. So in America, it's really huge on that, and that affects.
And of course, you can't show Russian artists.
And then
Middle East is complicated.
And then when they want to show Chinese, they show American-born
Chinese
artists. And that general impact is also impacting on the the Chinese contemporary art market. The phenomenon in China, which I feel is completely shocking, is if you go to any country or any market, their own collector really support the local artists. Mm-hmm. Hong Kong, we always support our Hong Kong artists. And if you go to Indonesia, Manila, Philippines, they all support their own artists. In China, a big, big difference is, if you see the auction market, it will tell you the thing is 70% of the art they buy is overseas. Mm. All right. Younger generation who has been educated abroad, they only recognize artists overseas. Whatever it is US hot, they will buy whatever, they will collect whatever they learn in US. So the fundamental problem today in China is that most of these younger collectors who are under 40 or even early 40s, they only like to collect overseas artists. They follow the American trend. Those who are above, they're still collecting Chinese artists. But then it creates a really big problem because the Chinese artists are not feeling that they're being supported. So we're waiting to see what is going to correct this trend of that. Hong Kong is still very exciting if we look at Hong Kong Art Basel. And what is a big problem today, Hong Kong Art Basel, is you see less and less American collectors coming in. And I think during our last Hong Kong Art Basel, there is an alarm. I think the embassy gave them an alarm of coming into Hong Kong, security alarm. So there's less and less American collectors, even American museum bring all the trustees coming and all their patrons coming in and into Hong Kong, which all of a sudden we are lack of that. So hopefully this will change because I think US-China relationship has to improve in many ways. So I think Hong Kong is still very exciting because they have not just China. China collectors are still coming to Hong Kong. They may not want Chinese art, they want international. And the whole Asia crowd is coming to Hong Kong and Europeans are coming to Hong Kong. So you still have that, but it's not as vibrant as if the American collectors are coming in. But in general, the Chinese collectors are still coming in, the Asian collectors are coming in. But when you look at London is after Brexit. Now is even worse because the tech situation, the non-dom situation. Many of my friends has moved out from UK. And with Brexit, I feel that it seems that the art capital in Europe has moved to Paris. Whether I like it or not, when I choose to open a gallery in Europe, I will choose to open in France, in Paris. Mm-hmm. So I think this is the general concern. The geographically definitely is changing.
It was bound to happen with Brexit. I think it was bound to happen.
I think Brexit happens. There's many changes as well. It's not just Brexit. No VAT is also a problem.
Oh, I know.
The tax problem, the VAT problem. In general, you don't even see Chinese tourism here because they couldn't do shopping here because of the VAT. How would they change the VAT? I don't understand. They should now put back the VAT reclaim in the VAT claim in UK, and that will help. So the Brexit already is a big problem. The movement is moving. All the people are moving to Europe.
No, sorry.
But can an art journalist become an art critic? Can they?
Can an artist become an art critic?
No, an art journalist. Journalists in art, yes. Becoming an art critics as such.
Yes. Yes, I think so. I think people can learn the sort of criticism of art. and be very, very good at it. If they have a mind that
opinionated.
Opinionated, yes. As we know, there are hundreds of ways of looking at
it. Yes, of course.
We all do it differently. But I think the one that really works for art criticism is the person who looks at a picture, let's say, or a sculpture or anything, and says, what was that artist trying to do? What are they really thinking about? What is it that they want to communicate to me? And has it worked? And how have they done it? And has it worked? Because that's, I think, the question that matters, really. Art criticism is not about saying, oh, this person uses beautiful colours and, you know, it's really nice and I like it or I don't like it or whatever. Yeah. It's actually about intention.
Artist's intention is really
It's
important.
About the thinking behind the work.
Yeah.
And it's about, sometimes it's about a theoretical framework, not always, but sometimes.
So how do you see that, you know, because it's subjective, isn't that really difficult, Cote, to have an art criticism?
I think that a good art critic doesn't necessarily feel they have to please everybody, and they don't
Absolutely.
Please everybody.
Absolutely.
They don't please everybody. They can be very influential, as we know, you know, in New York.
One art critic say everybody will follow.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Do you think
that doesn't really happen so much in Britain?
Doesn't happen here?
Not nearly so much, because we've got a lot of, I mean, it's one of the safety nets, as it were, is to have lots of press, not just have. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, in, let's say, in New York, you know,
New York Times.
The New York Times is so much more important than anything else.
Yes.
But we've got lots of papers, and therefore people can find the critics that they trust. It's like with movies. I don't know if you do the same thing, but I mean, I read two or three different movie critics, and I know quite often.
I don't. I just blindly go. I love movies.
Yeah.
I love movies. I just blindly go, and I don't even watch trailers.
Okay.
When I see, sometimes I just watch crap movies. I just love the movies. Cinema.
Great.
I love cinema.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
that's
I love those cinemas that I can buy food in and eat
there.
They're
so comfortable now.
I love that.
Yes,
I love
you can
that.
Have your drinks. And,
then people would say, why don't you sit at home? It's different. It doesn't have that atmosphere.
That's true.
So sometimes I really watch really crap movie that I fell asleep. Really bad.
It's very relaxing.
Yeah. So art criticism does not hold the power as if it is in US.
It does. It does. It is important what the critics say, and I think the artists mind very much, of course, what the critics say. But there aren't just one or two people who hold the power. That's the difference, that we've got more voices, which is good, because you can have somebody saying, you know, this show's actually wonderful, another person saying, I really didn't like that show, and that's fine, you know. That
25 years being in this art literary world, how do you feel?
Oh, I've had the nicest jobs in the world. I genuinely think that.
And because you can tell everybody to do their job.
Not really. It's because I know this is going to sound a bit pie, but it's true. Every single day I learn something. Every single day.
Oh, every single day?
I think so, yeah. Even if it's a new word that somebody uses, or, you know, one of the really young ones in my team comes into the office and they're wearing something amazing, or, you know, it's just something always. I learn something different. And every time, you know, every day I just open my emails and there'll be something in there that I've never heard of before.
So now, after 25 years, mm-hmm. you are retiring. So what are you going to do after your retirement?
I'm going to do the really, really nice bit of the job, which is that I'm going to just be a writer.
Because you love writing. You study English, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So I do some writing now and have done all these years, but my main job is editing and making sure and producing the pages. I just have to make sure that the pages are in the paper every single day. So, and I commission other people to do that, and I do some writing myself. So I will stop doing all that, all the organising, all the commissioning, the running, the responsibility, all that's gone, and I will just be writing about the arts and culture.
That's wonderful. This is what you love.
Yeah, yeah.
Love the best.
It's ideal. I'm so happy.
It's such a great pleasure to have you here, Jen. I have such a wonderful time speaking to you, learning about your thoughts and your insight. And I hope to see you soon and you come back again when you start being a writer. I have to invite you again as a writer.
Thank you, Pearl. I've enjoyed it so much. I was really thrilled to join you on your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Anne.